few times a year, we've done a series called Questions I Was Afraid to Ask, where you kind of bring up a topic that, you know, how come we don't talk about this in church? And so, you know, kind of try to address it. And see, I'm fully aware that as I bring up this, the topic of, you know, Christians and environmentalism, most, who here has heard a sermon about this in the last 2 years? Not very many hands go up. Me neither. And so I'm kind of nervous because there's a fair chance that as I start talking about some of this stuff, just bringing up the topic, that for some of you, there's a little kind of red flag that's going to go up in your head and go, ding, ding, ding. You haven't heard about this in church. Ding, ding, ding. Church is supposed to be about God and Jesus and stuff. Ding, ding, ding. Why is he talking about trees? Ding, ding. You know, and you're thinking that I'm going off on some wild, crazy tangent. Okay? Promise will stay in the Bible. Okay? Some of you will be equally frustrated from the other side because it'll be a little bit like lancing a wound. And as I start to talk about this, it's going to release some deep-seated frustration of why in the world haven't we been talking about this? And you're not going to think I've gone far enough. So either way, you know, you can shoot at me a bit later. But please be nice. This is very hard. Okay? And so to give you a little bit of background on this and why I think in the church we haven't talked about environmentalism, I want to talk about a bit about my background. So I got to tell you a story about hippies, loggers, and my scientist father. That's actually, well, as a kid, that's how sort of how I remember him. There's my brothers and I, we could really get him worked up every now and again. It's a little bit like that. But you see, I grew up in a town, next slide, Nelson, B.C., so it's kind of on the north side of the border, just a little bit past Spokane. And it's a town that, if you were to imagine it, it's like, kind of like Leavenworth without the Lederhosen, you know. And if you add logging into that, you sort of get the feel for the town. Lots of trees, lots of mountains, about the same size. And the two dominant cultures in the town, especially growing up, one was logging. I mean, it's a town of folks that they work out in the woods and cutting down trees, and you know, you build houses. A good chance some of that comes from the Nelson area. The other thing that was true about the area is that it got a big population boom right around the Vietnam era with draft dodgers, to be honest. And so it's kind of like Woodstock came north of the border and was cryogenically frozen in the Canadian woods. And so there's this interesting clash of culture at times, because you could go down to a grocery store and here you've got the little, you know, the VW hippie van, you know, coming in. It's got little, you know, it's kind of sputtering and a little smoke out the back, you know, a little hippie van. And then you're right next to it, you know, a big old pickup truck jacked up, you know, and the loggers and the hippies, and I realize I'm stereotyping here, so just bear with me. I'm kind of telling you the recollections of a child. As an adult, you realize not everybody fits so easily into these camps, but bear with me. So the loggers and the hippies tended not to talk to each other very much, because that was a good thing, because when they did have things to say, it was very rarely nice. And sometimes kind of strange things would happen. Like, it wasn't uncommon if there was a new logging development happening that there'd be a big protest beforehand, like before a big clear cut or something. And in some extreme cases, you know, the loggers would get quite upset because, you know, some of the things that would happen is people go and they'd spike the trees, you know, put big nails and stuff all through the trees. So for some loggers, if they're cutting through and they hit that, it's going to, at best, destroy their saw, at worst, kill them. So there was some tension. They didn't talk too well to each other. Both were very passionate about what they were doing. And for the most part, in the churches, it was more of the logger camp that would show up. The other thing that was true with the hippie culture is that, at least where I grew up, is now here, you know, if you're in a school or something and you say, hey, are you religious? and somebody says yes, you say, oh, okay, what denomination do you go to? Kind of assuming that if you're religious, you're probably Christian in some form. And so you say, are you Lutheran? Are you Catholic? Are you Baptist? What are you? You know, up where I grew up, partially because of this culture, if you ask somebody if you're religious, they're like, well, so are you Ekankar? Are you New Age? Are you a Wiccan? Are you Satanist? Are you Buddhist? You know, who's your Swami? It's an entirely different conversation, at least within sort of the hippie culture, as best I remember, realizing I'm stereotyping here. This is not always true, okay? But it did make conversation in the church a whole lot more difficult because, see, in the church, we just kind of go, at least I think this is what was happening, is they go, well, environmentalists equal hippies equal anti-Christians. So in the church, we didn't talk about that kind of, you know, environmental stuff because you just wanted to get as far away from what we perceived as being this terrible threat to Christianity. You know, hippies and whatnot, and hippie ideas and things like that. So I don't know if that exactly has happened here in the lovely United States of America, but I think it's kind of interesting that as you ask a question about this, that very few hands go up. Have you heard about environmentalism talked about in the church? Because it's sort of funny, because when you open up the Bible and you start reading, like, let's say from the start, you go about 26 verses in and you're confronted with the theme. If you've got your Bibles, let's open them up. Let's see what's going on in there. So Genesis chapter 1. Verses 26 through 31, there's been a whole bunch of, you know, and the things have been created and all sorts of good stuff. And we're getting in here to the sixth day. And then God said, let us make human beings in our image and in our likeness so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. And so God created, back up a bit. Thanks. Wow. That's power. Okay. And so God created human beings in His own image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Well, we've done that. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Next, please. Thanks. And then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. It will be yours for food. And all the beasts of the earth and the birds of the sky and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that He had made. And it was good. It was very good. So one of the first scriptural principles we see in terms of why humans are here, next slide please, is that humanity has been entrusted with the stewardship of God's creation. To rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, the livestock and the fields. That's part of why we're created. It's not the entirety of it. You know, we're created for relationship with God. But part of that relationship with God is, here God says to these, at this point, two people, go fill the earth, multiply, and take care of it. So we got 6+ billion of us now. From the North Pole to the South Pole to every fire, you know, telephone pole in between, right? All over the place. Wow, we've done a great job. We're all over the world. And we've been entrusted with ruling over creation. Yikes. Ruling. Wow. Hey, you rule. Or we do. Now, what's the difference between, let's say, a good, because we understand rulership. You know, even in a democratic society, we understand how this works. What's the difference between a good president and a bad president? Who do bad presidents only think of? Themselves. That's right. A good president is one who, with the authority of the office, cares for everybody in the country, raises, you know, makes the entire country better. That is the mark of a good president or a good governor or a good mayor or a good king or whatever you want in a rulership title. Is you make things better. A bad one only makes things better maybe for a few. A truly awful one makes things only better for herself or himself. So are we, if we've been entrusted with the rulership of creation, how do you think is our scorecard? Now we've been appointed, not elected. But who do you think is going to vote for us? The second scriptural principle you find in the Old Testament and in the New. And I got to give you a little bit of background on these passages here. So as God creates the world, He specifically gives a message to Abraham and Abraham's children as one nation to be a light to the entire world, so people can see what it looks like when people have a relationship with God. Something that's supposed to be a contagious thing, starting with one country. So the country goes from being nomadic to being slaves in Egypt, and then finally God frees them. You know, remember the whole Moses thing? Charlton Heston, let my people go. Moses and Metamucil. So, some of you will catch that in a minute. So the people were taken out of Egypt, out of slavery, and they're being given a land. And so in Leviticus is one of the books where you see sort of the laws of the land being set up. And in Leviticus 25, there's an interesting kind of thing that's going on here, is that every 7 years is kind of, the whole country goes into reset. If you've been sold into slavery, you're free. If you've got a debt, it's done. And this, Leviticus 25, 4 through 6. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a year of Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest. Whatever the land yields during the Sabbath year will be food for you, for yourself, your male and female servants, and the hired worker and temporary resident who live among you. So part of the job is to care for the land. Give it a break every 7 years. Or maybe in modern terms, it'd be a system of crop rotation. You don't just make the land yield and yield and yield and yield. You don't just produce, 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 produce. You rest. Right? Unfortunately, they never did it. They got set up by God. They had this instruction from God, and they never, ever, with this law especially, they never followed it. Ever. And so about 499 years later, after they've gone through a variety of kings and they've adopted some of the cultures of the surrounding countries and all the things they were told not to do, God's getting ready to kind of start again. I mean, some folks are going off into exile. The Babylonian army is about to come in and wipe out almost everything. And you see this verse in 2 Chronicles. So after Babylon has come sweeping through and most of the people have lost their homes and everything, it says the land enjoyed its Sabbath rest. All the time of its desolation, it rested. Until the 70 years were completed in fulfillment of the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah. So the people wouldn't give the land a break. They insisted on pushing it and pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And so God said, okay, if you're not going to take care of the land, I am. In the New Testament, we see some similar concepts. In Romans, the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself would be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in pains of childbirth right up to the present time. This takes us to the second scriptural principle.
it's this.
Next slide, please.
When humanity sins and is alienated from God, creation suffers. When the nation of Israel refused to follow God, the land ached until God gave it a break. Romans says the whole world is groaning and waiting for people to be made right with God, for the children of God to be revealed. When people live in harmony with God, in right relationship with God, creation benefits as a result. And conversely, when we live out of sync with God's ways, the world feels the pain. That kind of makes sense? Wait a second, I thought church was about God and Jesus and all that stuff. Why are you talking about this? So, let me give you an illustration. Where'd they go? There were some keys. Will you toss me up those keys, Dave? Go along. We're good. Yeah. Okay. So, I caught them. Here's an illustration that might help. So about 3 years ago, when we were getting this church, you know, started, one of the miracles that took place was because of a mutual friend, Greg Loomis, who's the assistant principal of the school. We were having conversation when I was still over in Chicago because of this mutual friend, and. As in our first sort of test run service, Greg hands me this key right here. This is the key to the front door of this building, $18 million building. That's a lot of trust. This key right here. It's an $18 million, the key to an $18 million building. And on Sunday mornings, we have been given kind of the authority to do in here what we'd like to do. We do all the church stuff and people connect with each other and all these kind of things. We've been given the trust of an $18 million key in order to do that. And in here, at least in this space, we get to do what we want. But what if? What would it say about the relationship between now our church and the administration of the school, if when we left the school, we left garbage all over the place, maybe busted some windows, we left lights on, water, running in the faucets. Do you think that would help the relationship or harm it? Or, Jim's right, probably end it. We've been given an incredible trust in this wonderful little key. And it's the relationship that matters, ultimately. It's, we have a relationship with the administration, and we pay some rent, and they treat us good, we treat them good. It's been terrific. Say thank you to the Eastmont administrators and the taxpayers of East Wenatchee. Wow, this is cool. But we guard that trust, right? Let's say you loan your friend a car or a house or anything of value. You expect that friend to treat that car with respect. They're not going to drive it like they stole it, right? If they do, it's just a car. It's just stuff. What does it matter? But it harms the relationship. Harms the relationship. So as we talk about environmentalism, if you love God, we need to love people and we need to love His stuff. And look around. This is it. The world is His stuff. He made it. He made it for us. He invites us to enjoy it and prosper in it. He gave us the key. metaphorically speaking. But how we treat the world around us, it's not necessarily exactly about our relationship with God, but it sure is a reflection of it. Love God, you love His stuff, you love His people. Right? Sort of makes sense. Why don't we talk about this in church? I don't know. So, what do we do? Love it. Well, actually, back up a little bit. First thing we can do. Love it. God gave us this incredible world. Actually, every picture here that you've seen in these little sequence is this is from my office, actually. Thursday, took backpack with a Bible and notes and sat up on the top of Saddle Rock. And those are pictures from that. Looking around. I'm reading these passages about you know, God's giving us creation. And no lie, this bald eagle, just I could hear the wind moving around its wings. Just goes flying by and just like, yes. God's made this incredible world for you. For you. Get out there. Love it. Go take a walk. Go take a hike. Go sit on a boat. You know? Fishing rod optional. But get out there and love it. This is God's gift. This is His stuff. It's for you. To use political language, go visit the constituency, man. You've been given, humanity has been given dominion over this. Go visit the constituency. Say, how are we doing, Earthworms? You're a vote for me. Go love it. Enjoy it. And thank God for it. And care for it. Care for it. I want to throw out some ideas. These are just ideas. You're going to come up with better ideas than I've got. But when we love something, and we appreciate something, we find all sorts of different ways to do it. Here's some ideas. Here's some ideas for ways that we can care for God's creation. Simple little things. You know? Eat locally. Eat seasonally. The farmer's market has a program. There's even things out there. Have you ever had really fresh fruits and vegetables? They're great. Plus, you know, support the local economy. Support our local farmers and orchardists. They are working hard. We've got labor laws and environmental laws here, so we do things right, and they work their tails off to do that kind of stuff. So they produce good food, and it doesn't need to drive halfway around the planet for you to enjoy it and eat it. So as much as you can, local, seasonal, drive less, carpool more, bike and walk more. I'm so happy that many of you, you know, when you come to church, you fill up your car, you bring some friends along, and you know, you come as a group. That's a terrific way to show care, not just for God by, you know, we're using less resources than we need to, but for God's people. Hey, man, come to church with me. Carpool. It's good. Recycle. There's actually, in the little insert, there's the number of waste management services. Call one number. It's totally free. Say, hey, I'd like some recycling bins. They show up at your house. You recycle. I'm a recycler. Wow. It's free, but most people don't even do it. Simple, but most people don't even do it. You know, I realized I forgot to talk about my scientist father here. Just go back. Okay, so hang on, just. Okay, little pause here because I want to finish the story. So I told you about the hippies and I told you about the loggers. I got to talk about my dad. So my dad, he grew up in England and. He was a Boy Scout and discovered he loved the outdoors. And so he decided he wanted to be a tree scientist, or in fancy words, he's a silviculturalist. Yeah, I didn't know what that meant either. But he's a tree scientist, and so they don't have many trees in England, so he came over to Washington State, and at UW he met my mom. And so then they decided to move to Nelson. And he worked, you know, his until he retired for the Canadian Forest Service doing research. So he'd go up in the mountains and look at the different ecosystems and things like that, and basically trying to figure out, so what makes an area thrive? You know, so issues like biodiversity and, you know, watersheds and all this kind of stuff. This is the stuff of life, you know, for him. And the thing that was sort of odd sometimes is that, see, as a guy that's kind of dedicated his life into figuring out what makes ecosystems work well, being so frustrated with the conversations on both sides. Seeming sometimes, I know this isn't always true, but sometimes where the loggers are concerned only with the economics of it, the immediate economics of it. Saying that's just plain bizarre. Because if you're a logger and you want, does it help you if the forests don't grow back? No. Or from what he found sometimes the extremes on the hippie side was that where responses to environmental issues would seem to be predominantly emotional rather than kind of based in scientific research or based in, you know, what as far as we know is the best thing for this area. So folks would come in and maybe make assumptions like clear cutting is always bad and selective logging is always good. I remember as a kid, he would tell me, no, you can't make those simple assumptions. You know, you got to look at an area and say, what's best for this area? Sometimes selective logging, you know, you put in roads and you have traffic that's moving through there, and trees will never regrow on that area. While with clear cutting, in some cases, sometimes you're going to just take out all the trees. There's very low impact, and it's kind of like what happens in nature. You know, you burn off the slash, and then 5 years later, there's a whole new thriving ecosystem there. But you can't make those assumptions. And so here I'm, you know, growing up in this culture of people that you know, were all highly invested in the environment, but weren't talking to each other about anything at all. And this wonderful scientist father that, you know, we've been recycling as long as I can ever remember. We have a compost heap, you know, back behind our house. I thought that was normal. Who knew? You know, growing our own vegetables and all sorts of stuff. And he's not a hippie. He's a scientist. And he's a Christian. So funny how it's hard to find common ground. But it seems to me that the church should be the first place where we can open up those kind of conversations and bring people that thought they had nothing in common, bring some stuff together and start getting some good happening. So ways we can care. You know, you might discover you like vegetables. Grow some food yourself. Consume fewer resources. There's a whole bunch of ideas on the insert in there. Ways that we can make a difference. Steps that we can take. And I do hope. Not because this is like you go to church and, oh yeah, so, no, the pastor said I have to do this if I'm going to go to this church. No. Didn't say that. What I am saying is grow in your relationship with God, and part of loving God is loving His people and loving His stuff. Love God, love people, love God's stuff. Take care of it. So I would strongly urge you, encourage you, challenge you, maybe even a little bit more, poke and prod you. Is there some step you can take so that in your life you're more reflective of a deep appreciation for what God has given us in this wonderful gift of creation? Maybe your step is to go take a prayer walk this week. Just go up a mountain. Look around a little bit. Go to the farmer's market. You know, support local agriculture. Whatever it is. What's one step that you can take to increase your care for God's people and God's stuff? Final little reminder in there, because sometimes as with anything good, we can forget the, you know, like you miss the forest for the trees, or you sort of miss the point. Caring for the environment is never an excuse for not caring for people. We care for the environment because we care for people. Because we love God. Who better to love God's stuff than God's people? Right? So, let's open the conversation up in church. We can talk about this stuff. We can talk about making this world better. We can talk about getting groups working together. And we can do a better job of loving God's stuff. Would you pray with me? Lord, thank you for the gift of creation. For clean air and clean water and good food to eat. Thank you for the sheer beauty of the valley in which we live. We look out our window and you amaze us. Lord, keep our eyes open to beauty, that we might be people who appreciate what you've given. Oh Lord, forgive us, for so often we neglect the gift. We treat your stuff with contempt. We dirty it as if it doesn't matter. We dirty our neighbor's yard as if our neighbor doesn't matter. Lord, may your children reflect your love for people and your love for your creation. Amen.